You're listening to The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heidmark at RadioArian.com.
Comrades, this is your host of the Daily Traditionalist, Matthew Heimbach, and I'm here today to kick off another amazing week of our show. Insert cheers here. If this wasn't live, we could hit the laugh track button or something like that. But I'm joined today by my loyal friend, comrade, co-host, and head of propaganda for the Traditionalist Worker Party, Mr. Jason Augustus. Jason, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Matt. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, you know, it's always a pleasure to be able to have you here and to be able to get your insight. And I wanted to start off to be able to have you here as my resident Italian to talk about what happened in Italy.
what happened in Italy?
Well, of course, the vote came for no on the constitutional referendum yesterday. And of course, what that means is the left-leaning leader of Italy has now stepped down. And this entire process was to try and streamline Italian politics, because the way it historically been is it is a bureaucratic nightmare to make changes in Italy, which makes sense. The Italian people are very, localist sort of people, very tied into their local communities. And they really don't want, especially a Brussels puppet state, to be able to steamroll them. So this vote, it was 60% to 40%. It wasn't close. It was a blowout, basically, of the people rejecting these reforms put forward by the pro-EU government, saying that they wanted to basically cripple one of the arms of the government to streamline this process to better easily pass things. And economically, the EU is asking for more things from the Italians. Same thing they've done with the Greeks. Of course, we know with the Greeks, I was there 2 years ago to see the protests being held by farmers who were actually rioting, like actual farmers rioting against the Greek state and meeting with Golden Dawn the same day, because the EU had forced all these restrictions, all these extra taxes that were being placed on the farmers, that were being placed on average people. Of course, in Greece, they finally just changed the law last year to make it that your home could be foreclosed on. It used to be no matter what. Your family's home is your family's home, but now they're foreclosing on those to get money to pay to the EU. So Italy has seen what's happened to Greece. They've seen what happens with austerity. The people are saying enough is enough. We're not going to make it easier for Brussels to rape us economically and socially. The Italian people are also talking about how the EU wants more money when they're the ones being inundated with refugees. Italy is right there on the front lines. So there's a lot of things going on. So this vote, while not specifically about the European Union, is kind of about the European Union, because the leader did say that he was going to step down. Matteo Renzi said he was going to resign if it lost. He now did, which means they can move forward and possibly have new elections, which will likely strengthen Eurosceptic parties. And it really is an Italian rejection, this continued populism against the state of the EU and the way the EU wants to remake every European nation to make them puppet states. So cheers to Italy.
Yeah, cheers.
You gotta give me more than that. These are your people.
Yeah, hip hip hooray on that one. Now, the thing is that Italy has gone through so many different things like this. Not like this exactly, but I don't know if you're aware or if the listeners are aware that Italy has been trying to split between North and South for a long time. I'm pro-split, by the way. Mm-hmm. That's... There should be a Northern. The cultures are fundamentally different. The history is fundamentally different. Not that one is better than the other. They're just different. Mm-hmm. It's
like a Nord.
Yeah, like a Nord. It's just, it's tough to say what, when you say the Italian people, mm-hmm. because right now, and for, ever since it became just Italy, there hasn't been an Italian consensus. Mm-hmm. But to see that they both agree on this, both North and South, that's to me a good sign.
Well, I think it's really exciting. I mean, again, things are rolling forward. And on the not rolling forward side, Austria. We had the Austrian elections yesterday. And, I was thinking that the last election, I believe the Green Party candidate and the Austrian Freedom Party candidate were separated by less than like 20,000 votes. And it was proven they're actually hiring Austrian anti-fascists to count mail ballots. And the fraud was just so clear of ballots being thrown in the trash that it was deemed that they had to have a re-election. So that was 6 months ago. They had the re-election, and the FPÖ, the Austrian Freedom Party, lost. Hofer, who was the FPÖ candidate, lost, and he lost by a far wider margin than the initial election. So how could it do it? We know the left cheated. We know the left cheated. The left wants more refugees, all these things. How do they FPÖ lose? And I think it's very simple. It was their cuckage. They did this to themselves. And I'm going to actually say Austrian elections, still a win for nationalism, because there is always this temptation for respectability. You know, it's a speech I gave a couple months ago at our party meeting. They're all going to laugh at you. There's always in the back of your mind, and this happens to all of us, that we should go from alt-right to alt-light. We should always moderate. You know, maybe if we're just a little more respectful, the people will come to us. And right now, we see with these Austrian elections, because Hofer just spent the last 6 months saying, oh, I'm not a radical, we should stay in the EU. He made some comments previously that maybe he wanted to leave the EU, but now, oh, we want to just maybe renegotiate a few things. We're not radical, we just want to have a sensible immigration policy. And he came within 20,000 votes of winning. He might have actually won if it wasn't for the fraud the first time, by the FPÖ being known as like a Nazi party. Like, kick the immigrants out, get us out of the EU. And he spent the last 6 months losing. He did everything he possibly could to lose. So I want to know your thoughts on this, that as we're moving forward, like, not only in Europe, but in the United States, I think looking at this example is a very, very important thing for us, because people want strong leadership. They don't want people to compromise. We're facing radical problems. We need radical solutions. We're not looking for the status quo. And this guy went from being, he could have been the Donald Trump of Austria to like the Jeb Bush of Austria. Very low energy, you know, it was very, very sad, you know. That's all I can say, sad. So I want to know your thoughts on that.
Well, on that in particular, I mean, that, like you said, it's a broader scope than that. It's just the world is taking a more radical turn, a more extremist turn. I know Germany makes that distinction that, there's a difference between radical and extremist. I really don't think that there is. I was talking to a girl recently,
tell me more.
it was just a fun, you know, little conversation about, you know, the right-wing death squads, we need them, you know, because of how bad things are getting here. And this is just, you know, this is a normal chick. She's not, like, you know, super into any of this, but she was like, yeah, there needs to be some serious change here. And she had told me, you know, she realizes that the center is no more. Mm-hmm. There is no more center, there's no more moderate. And there's not even a prospect for it, because the whole world has gone extremist.
Yeah.
So everything is extreme. Unless you have picked the side, you're stagnant and you may as well be dead, because there is no center.
Well, I mean, and there can't be. And this idea that nationalists were seizing defeat from the jaws of victory. In this example, Austria, we seized defeat from the jaws of victory. They were so close. It would have been the first nationalist elected leader in Europe since 1945. It would have been absolutely amazing, and all they did, all the Austrian Freedom Party did, was flub it. They fumbled the ball on the 5-yard line. They were so close to a touchdown, but they had an aneurysm right there and just fumbled the ball. Because let's be honest, if you are going to ignore the media, you know, narrative, essentially, about evil Nazis, blah, 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 if you're going to take that stigma upon yourself, you want to be electing a real nationalist. You don't want half measures. That this is, I think, punishing the Austrian nationalist movement. And it's a lesson, because if Le Pen in France, right now with the French elections coming up, Le Pen doesn't deserve to win. And that's honestly the God's truth. Because first of all, in my opinion, the only Le Pen that should be leading the National Front is Jean-Marie Le Pen, the true nationalist, a man who has actually fought for his nation and has been uncompromising in terms of defending historical inquiry, defending the French people, understand there's an ethnic component. And when Marine Le Pen got in, she kicked out her own father from his party and drove out the monarchists and the hard right guys to replace them with Jews and homos. And now she's talking about how moderate she is on all these issues. And Sarkozy's party, you know, the Republicans, the conservative center right party, the guy that they just picked to be their presidential candidate, is more hardcore on immigration than Le Pen is. The so-called far-right candidate has cut so far for respectability that she's actually gone to the left of the center-right party. She's a centrist now in many ways. And you know what? She deserves to lose. Honest to goodness, Hofer deserved to lose, and she deserves to lose in France. And she doesn't have to lose. She doesn't have to lose. She could go ahead and be a real nationalist and actually speak to the people, excite them, turn them out to vote, and then implement policies to better their lives and better the French people. But I don't know if they're going to do it.
No, French politics haven't operated in that way, like, in a really, really, really long time. And we see
Vichy France did nothing wrong.
Listen, we see right now in contemporary France, the nationalist movements that are out there, some of them get pretty nasty. You know, burning down the refugee camps.
Allegedly.
But, I mean, the nationalists in France, the people of France, are very, very fed up. And they know that they don't have any power in their system to change anything. They're not blind to the fact that their leaders suck. They just know that they can't do anything about it in the same way that we thought that we couldn't do anything about it pre-Trump. I mean, Trump gave us a little glimmer of hope, but realistically, before all of that, we had none.
Yeah.
We had no hope in this system whatsoever. And even with Trump, we're still kind of like, I don't really know. But France knows for certain these politicians are not going to serve us. So they could throw out all the votes they want. It's not going to make a difference to the people, and it's not going to make a difference to how the people respond to that. And the eventual outcome of whatever happens with France is not going to be done by any kind of peaceful political means. It's going to be done probably really, really badly because of the failure of these politicians.
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't have to be that way. All it would take is, like, if Le Pen didn't stab her father in the back, that because he made it to the runoff election, probably I think it was like 15 years ago, and the National Front was rocking and rolling. And then she's decided to cuck on everything and alienate their base, alienate the fanatical youth supporters that they have. And she's not winning any more votes. She's actually losing votes. She's going to lose votes to the people that actually care most about immigration and keeping France for the French people. She's going to lose them to the conservatives, the pro-EU conservatives that want to gut the social support networks for the poor, for the elderly, just because they want the people that are invading France and demographically changing it out of their country. So this is just proof, comrades. I think it's such an important thing for us to look at, because there's just so much we as American nationalists can learn from Europe. I have learned so much from my European comrades. I love them to pieces. And there are movements that are uncompromising, movements like Golden Dawn, movements like the NPD, movements like the Nordic Resistance Movement, and others. I mean, basically, like, all of Poland, like, except for, you know, there's, like, one village leftist idiot, like, in every Polish town. But, you know, the Poles are pretty much all nationalists. There are Noah Dropped in Romania, and all these other groups, all these other amazing, amazing people, Czech Workers Party, I mean, folks I've met with that are uncompromising, and they're winning. And they're winning because they're building infrastructure and communities, and they're uncompromising. So, like Golden Dawn, going from a very small party to the third largest party in the Greek parliament, because they were consistent, because they didn't chase votes. They stood on principles. They stood on a foundation of faith and family and folk. And when the time came, people knew they could trust them. And this is the thing. We cannot let the population sway us in our positions. We have to be steadfast on the ground we stand on, because people need to know that we're consistent. People need to know that we're always going to fight for them. We're not going to betray them for political expediency or money or things like that. So I think from Austria, we're learning a very valuable lesson on what not to do.
Yeah, I completely agree. We're never going to give you up. We're never going to let you down.
Rickrolled!
That's principle. Rick Roll's a principle of our nationalism here, man. We won't.
I love that. That's all right. That's we should have had that planned as an outro, because that'd be a really funny outro. It's this lesson that we need to learn. Other exciting things. Speaking of being steadfast, so this was a Christmas message last year. It's getting a lot of play now in the West for this Christmas season. President Duterte, Rodrigo the Punisher Duterte, leader of the Philippines, my favorite, probably my favorite head of state right now, except for like President Putin, of where he said to the drug dealers, the thieves, the corrupt, and all these criminals that if they didn't stop and clean up their act, that this was the last Merry Christmas they were going to have. And now the Philippines is filled with bodies of the corrupt, the thieves, the murderers, the drug dealers, and all the other pushers of crime and vice. And he's got a 90% approval rating. So speaking of consistency, bam, Mr. Duterte, hats off to you. Three cheers for making the Philippines great again. What are your thoughts on Mr. Duterte?
He is wonderful. I watch his videos regularly. You know, even the old ones could be from last year. Doesn't matter. Still rings brilliantly today. He's a pleasure to listen to, and he's a pleasure to watch because he comes out as, you know, not this polished suit. He comes out as a man of the people, yeah. And he speaks for the people, and you know he serves his people very well. I one of my favorite quotes from him is was something about the U.S. But he said, "You're not my master. I have no master other than the Filipino people."
Well, it's 100% true, and you know his other statement that he made that really spoke to me is that a promise to the Filipino people is a promise to God, because he really understands this traditional thing. Like in Europe, in European civilization, we understood this for centuries, millennia even, of this idea that it is the noble's obligation. If you are in a position of economic or social or political power, you have an obligation to the people who are under you. And there's a relationship. It's an extended family. And the king was always the father of the nation. That's the way a leader has always been. This idea that he is the embodiment of the nation and he cares for all of his citizens as his children. And it's a positive, warm, loving relationship. And since the French Revolution, we've really betrayed all those principles in the West. But they're reasserting themselves, surely. You know, things are going very, very quickly. The nationalism train has no brakes. But for me, a Duterte is following the traditional understanding of what leadership is, that, you know, people, they're complaining about human rights, and he says, no. Like, you know, he curses a lot. So a lot of his quotes aren't, you know, we at the Daily Traditionalists try and be family friendly. So there's a lot of his quotes that are not.
Duterte is too extreme.
Yeah, he's too extreme for the Daily Traditionalist. he's a hardcore son of a gun, I tell you what. But his entire thing is like, screw your human rights, screw your United Nations. He even condemned the International Criminal Court. It was like, maybe we'll just bounce because you don't have a right to tell us what to do. Because his only responsibility, he's the leader of the Philippines. He is the leader of the Filipino people. He has one responsibility, and that's to defend them. And when radical Islamists in the Philippines were threatening his, they actually bombed one of his convoy. The lead vehicle was actually damaged in an IED attack. So, like, they're trying to kill him, but talking about ISIS and their affiliates launching attacks in the Philippines, the dude threatened to kill him and eat him. And he would do it. That crazy son of a gun, like, and I say crazy in the best way, I guarantee he would go on national television with a jihadist and, like, eat the dude and say, this is going to happen to every single one of you, and then throw them to the hogs, you know, so in their belief system, they're not getting into heaven. That is the sort of guy he is, and the reason he is that way is he is a fanatic for his people. He wants them to be safe on the streets. He wants them to have a nation that's governed by them, not by these international interests. He is a fanatic for his people, and they love him. He only won the vote with a little over 50% just a few months ago. But now that he's been implementing his promises, he's been cleaning up corruption, he's been showing that he is a real leader. He's not a politician. He is a leader. He has over 90% approval rating. So even the majority of the people that voted against him in the election support him now because he is a leader fighting for them. Truly, like, an example. Like, who would have thought that I'd be sitting here, you know, in 2016, the year of all happenings, and I think for us in the West, one of the best examples for leadership, and, you know, it's not the death squads or things like that, that make him so great. It's the fact that he's just uncompromising on the world stage. A nation like the Philippines, a very humble nation, a very humble and loving people. Any person I've ever known that's gone to the Philippines says they are the kindest, most Christian, caring people you could have. And to say that my people will not be taken advantage of, they will not be abused, I'm going to fight for them. That we in the West could learn so much from men like Duterte, just in his fanatical devotion to his people. I think that's a very exciting thing. And if we compare and contrast the FPU and the Le Pens versus a Duterte, if a Duterte had been running in Austria to say, like, no, we're not going to let our girls be raped, No, we're not going to be able to have our jobs be stolen. No, we're not going to have terrorism in our streets. We are going to make Austria great again. And I don't care what Angela Merkel, I don't care what Brussels, I don't care what the U.S. says. I'm going to fight for my people and take care of them. He would have won the election with 80% of the vote.
Yeah. You know, I mean, you don't leave me a whole lot of wiggle way to come in and say anything. You just kind of get it all out there. Yeah.
Well, is there more obscure 80s lyrics we could go with? We didn't start the fire. Oh, golly, it's good times. So on the Italian thing, I'm gonna razz you, Mr. Italian. So there was a girl, an actress, that promised the no voters. So we're talking about 60% of the population, I guess 30% it would be men, voted no. Promised a little bit of loving. So did that make the difference? I know you Italians are a sensual people, you know. What's up with that?
I would venture to say that maybe some men were swayed by that, but we Italians are very good-looking people. And we don't have a particular problem with, the ladies in that way, as far as the stereotype goes. So, yeah, we don't really care. I mean, you know, if we wanted cheap pictures on the internet of some boobs and some butt, there's no shortage of it. There's no shortage of internet in Italy. I don't think that really swayed it very much.
Hashtag degeneracy, hashtag The youth in Germany burning all the books and pornography did nothing wrong. But the reason I bring that up, just razzing a little bit, is, of course, in America, just to compare the difference between, real nations and the USA, the place that we currently live, we had, of course, Madonna, you know, who is, like, 60, I think. She was promising sex acts here in the United States for people to vote for Hillary Clinton, and Hillary didn't win. But you have attractive women in Italy that shows a little bit of a difference. Of course, I do not support promoting that sort of action, but I do think that's interesting that in Italy you had a very well-known actress who was like actually beautiful and young compared to a 60-year-old broken-down hag in the United States. If that doesn't tell you a distinction, you know, people have been talking about the comparison between having Bill Clinton as the first lady versus Melania Trump. That's another thing. All you need to know.
Did Madonna say that she was going to do something sexual if people voted for Hillary?
Yeah.
I think, was that why Trump won? Because I believe she was 60 like 20 years ago.
I don't know if she can sing like a virgin anymore. That's all I can say. She would not have been touched for the very first time in many, many moons. But of course now I don't think anyone would want to touch her. But that's neither here nor there. We're getting caught in the weeds.
No more Madonna talk, please. I don't know how she still exists.
Well, because she is a material girl in a material world. So we're in a lyrics binge right now, ladies and gentlemen. But we have, looking forward to kind of close out our show the last couple minutes to talk about that. ISIS has declared that January 20th is going to be a very bloody day, because Donald Trump has been elected and he said he was going to take care of ISIS. And of course, ISIS is on the retreat everywhere. Now what we see is they're saying, because when he takes the oath of office, they are going to launch terror attacks in the United States and in Europe. And that is something that is a little interesting. So, Jason, what's your knee-jerk reaction on that?
Tap beer, aloha snack bar. ISIS is more and more obviously Hillary supporter. It just seems that way. Like, constantly, more and more, every day, they're making it more and more clear that they support Hillary. I mean, maybe they should put that into one of their new, really high-quality songs.
For the record, like, who does their stuff? I think I've talked about this on the show before, but, like, their magazine, I don't know if you've ever gotten to read their magazine, and the most recent issue, actually, was just talking about doing knife attacks and making it like a video game. It's really interesting. Really what they're doing with, like, modern Western Muslims. Of course, these Wahhabists, getting all the support from Saudi Arabia and this backing. But it's a very youth-oriented literature they do. And, saying, like, don't go get a gun. use a car, use a knife, and stuff like that. Of course, just right after, we have a radical Islamic, Wahhabi attack in Ohio. So this is already being put into practice. But these ideas that they're disseminating to take any situation that you could be in your everyday life and turn it into a terrorist spot, talking about going into hospitals, talking about going into schools, talking about just, on the street, you're at the grocery store, that they are actually putting out there in this propaganda to tell young, Wahhabis in the West that you need to get the high score count and you need to go and kill as many infidels as possible and to use weapons like knives, things you're not going to expect until a guy yells Allahu Akbar and starts stabbing. So this is something that I think they've been planning for a very long time, and it's not based on centralization. You don't need to get resources from Syria to make it happen. It's stuff you can go to Walmart and buy a butcher knife. You can take a car that you own and use that as a weapon. So they're encouraging these people to commit terror attacks with everyday things to make life on the streets of Europe and the United States dangerous. And they're saying that they're going to take this fight because they're losing to the Russians. They're losing to Iran. They're losing to Hezbollah. They're losing to Syria over in the Middle East. And they want to take the fight here. And they want to use normal, everyday things to really terrorize our society.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it sounds like a ShamWow, except with death. It's like, hey, there can be death anywhere. You can make death here and death there.
Billy Mays here with OxyClean.
It's like it's like some kind of like a Jewish funded Arab death ShamWow. I'm sorry to make light of these. I don't mean to make light of any of it. It's just that's just what it seems like.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, this is Jewish. Like, the Wahhabis, the entire system, the reason we have radical Islamic extremism is because of Zionism. Because the Zionists and the Saudi Arabians have aligned together against the secular Arab nations, the nationalist Arabs in the Middle East, and against the West. So they are tied in so intricately together. The Saudi royal family and the Israeli government and international Jewry are so butts to nuts. They're so connected with one another. They just do an elephant walk throughout the entire Middle East, frat boy style, of how close they really are with one another. And their position, Saudi Arabia and thereby also Israel are the largest state sponsors of terror. Because all of these mosques, all of these things in the West that are promoting this radical Islamic extremism, this violence, trying to turn young Muslims into butchering women and children, and this is what they're saying in their own materials, it's coming from the Saudi government. The Saudi government is funding all of these institutions in the West, the Anjam Chowdhury's of the world, we refuse to call that out because they're our geopolitical allies. And this is, for me, people ask me all the time, why do I side with Iran? Why do I side with Lebanon? Why do I side with Assad and things like that? It's because that the nationalist movements want to be able to destroy this cancer, of what Israel is doing, of what the Saudis are doing, of what American foreign policy is doing, of supporting states that radicalize these Muslims, bring them into the West, and then they're killing people on the streets in fulfillment of what their paymasters educated and radicalized them to do. American and European immigration policy, the reason it's so dangerous is not only demographically, but with terrorism and things like that, is directly due to our support of these governments in the Middle East who are educating and arming these people.
Yeah. There's that standoffishness about what your alliances are based on race or religion and all this stuff. That's not something that I personally align with either. It's like if I were to go outside and see the neighbor's house getting eaten by termites, and one of those termites was able to speak and said, "We are doing this because we're fighting the international Jew," I would have to side with them termites. because there is a deeper connection and there's something more going on. And so long as you're attacking the Jew and so long as you're hated by the Jew, you are a good person.
Well, exactly. There's a reason why ISIS doesn't attack Israel. There's a reason why ISIS doesn't attack Saudi Arabia. There's a reason that ISIS is attacking nationalists in Syria. They attack Baathists and Shias and Christians in Iraq and other places because they're simply boot boys, just like the anti-fascists in the West are the boot boys of the international Jew. ISIS in the Middle East is the boot boy of the international Jew, and they're part of this overall system. So this is the battle of the 21st century, is nationalism versus globalism, but that could also just be Jews versus those that are opposed to being dominated by Jews.
It's just Jews. I think that interchangeably, globalist, Zionist, international elites, whatever you want to call them, whatever name you want to give them, cosmopolitans, and whatever race you want to stamp on them for that matter too. They could be Arab Jews, European Jews, Black Jews. If you're a Jew, you are a Jew.
Well, and as we close out, it's the also the mindset. You know, I mean, Evola talked about it a lot. About the Jewish mindset. It's not just the racial thing. It's that the traitors, the Angela Merkels of the world, the traitors within our own ranks have a Jewish soul. Because this Jewish soul is materialist. It is selfish. It hates everything that is beautiful. Whether it is an art, they encourage pornography. Whether it's nation, they encourage immigration and demographic displacement. Where there is peace, they encourage war. That this Jewish spirit has infected. It's this mercantile, capitalist, self-serving mindset that has influenced the minds of so many leaders around the world. And that's when we say that we're fighting the Jews. It's not just the biological ones. It's those that share this Jewish spirit. The traitors within our own ranks. You know, Kadriano, of course, talked about it extensively. Those that sell out your own people, they're not just traitors. They are, like the Borg, have been assimilated into this Jewish power structure. Jason, closing out, give me a 10-second final thought.
10-second final thought. Ally with anybody who is fighting the enemy Jew. Even if they are termites.
Giant termites or normal-sized termites?
They can be any-sized termites. And people like Merkel, regardless of who they are, they're worse than a Taco Bell fart. They need to be blown away in the wind just the same.
Well, we'll leave it on that. Love it. Jason, thank you so much for being here. Thank you for your commentary. And thank you, dear listeners, for being here for another edition of The Daily Traditionalist. Looking forward to being here tomorrow. Have a great day, and hail victory!
Be tuned into The Daily Traditionalist with Matthew Heimbach at RadioArea.com.